From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for March 20th, the calming Sunday after Illinois' primary election day on Tuesday, and the first full official day of spring. Welcome to our weekly political recap of the week that was and what's up in the days ahead. Grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, as we've got another busy political weekend to talk about. Well, Dave, happy spring.
I loved your introduction there. Happy spring to you, Rick. The calming Sunday after the election and the first day of spring, I am now taking a deep cleansing breath.
I think we could all use a deep cleansing breath.
And exhaling
breath.
Slowly,
yes.
And thoughtfully.
A little zen, a little yoga type thing.
Exactly.
Going. Yeah, well, it's been quite a week. Actually, quite a couple of weeks, and I like to joke that at election time, I'm not fit for human consumption. Well, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, you can take that in so many
ways. I know. But a lot happened just in this past week, and I'm just now starting to get out of that pure political bubble that I was living in and adjust to everyone else's reality. At election time, it's kind of like I'm an accountant at tax season. And it gets hard to try to juggle everything.
Sure. Well, absolutely. And especially with the way everything locally here, nationally, it's just incredible what we're seeing here during this campaign.
Well, normally, you know, by the time you get to the Illinois primary and presidential election years, it hasn't necessarily meant that much in the past. I mean, we did move it up, the primary, to February in that first race of then Senator Barack Obama to try to help him get his delegates. But really, to see kind of the intensity of a full-scale political campaign, a presidential political campaign here in Illinois is something to behold. Because in the past, it seems like I've talked about what it's like when you're in Iowa or what it's like when you're in New Hampshire because nobody here really gets to see it. But, yeah, you got to see it pretty well.
Yeah, you did. And, you know, it's evident, obviously, with Trump's cancellation of his rally here the Friday before the election, not to mention Bernie Sanders being here, Hillary holding Hillary Clinton holding last-minute rallies at the Plumbers Union Hall.
And now we know why, after seeing those vote totals.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's right. So, and now it remains next stop, Arizona and Utah, I believe.
Right. That's coming up on Tuesday. Arizona, a winner-take-all state, and that'll be very interesting to watch as the events unfold there. There was one good thing I have to tell you about all of the political activity, and that was I didn't get a chance to really pay much attention to the Blackhawks. They went through a four-game losing skid before. Thankfully, you know, it's kind of like taking an aspirin when you've got a four-game losing streak. That's playing Winnipeg. You know, that's so that was just what we needed, just at the right time on the schedule. And now, of course, tonight they're playing
Minnesota,
the Wild, here at the United Center at 7:30 as the puck drop. And John and Troy have all the action right here on WGN Radio, so you don't need to change anything. And somehow I think I'm guaranteed to be getting some snarky text messages from Aunt Jo.
I was
going to
say, Aunt Jo, I was going to bring that up, but I wanted to tread lightly, as they say. Aunt Jo and you will be trading text messages this evening.
And the Hawks have not done well against Minnesota this season. So
be prepared.
I'm hoping for a different outcome. I'm hoping for a lot different outcome.
Speaking of texts and politics, we didn't have time last week to get into this, but the Trump rally, or the cancellation of the rally, I should say, at UIC, prompted phone calls from my friends and text messages from all over the country, you know. So what's going on in Chicago? And apparently, you know, some national media automatically comparing this to 1968.
Yeah, there was a lot of that kind of a default situation where people are talking about
a default
about
situation
60,
is a very good way of putting it.
And it's like, and I was, I did a radio show for a buddy of mine, Robin Johnson, out in Iowa, and he raised that issue too. And I said, well, you know, now granted, I was 10 years old at the time, but the issues of 1968 were so vastly different than, you know, what this was. And you know, sure, with the TV and everything, it kind of amplifies what people were talking about, you know, violence and all of this. And there were sporadic instances, but I was nowhere near.
The officers that were hit, you know, and you know, if you're not here and you're not aware exactly of all of the things that are taking place, you see this in another part of the country. And I guess you would equate that with what, you know, seeing now video of the riots that were on Michigan Avenue in 1968.
But when you think about 1968 and you really had a Democratic Party that was just torn inside itself, you had, I mean, you think of those events of 1968 and you had Lyndon Johnson, the Vietnam War.
The assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Exactly. Shortly before the Illinois primary.
And Hubert Humphrey becomes the nominee.
Right. So, I mean, that, plus you had the issues of the late Richard J. Daley and his instructions to the Chicago police and different times.
Very, very different. Yeah, very
but,
different.
Well, and one other thing, too, excuse me, with the politics going away is also these past 2 days, past couple of days, with college basketball and tournament time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't normally follow college basketball because it seems like there's always another game. But with the tournament, when it's one and done, it's really exciting to watch this.
It is. And this is all, you know, a great arrival of spring type of thing. Every time the brackets come out and the NCAA starts, I always think, yeah, spring is on its way, not far away. Forgive my ignorance here. SIU was not in it. At all?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I know, but Ball State wasn't.
But as of yesterday afternoon, I think it was, after Michigan State crashed, ESPN reported that, you know, they have run a big contest of, you know, can you do the perfect bracket? And they said they only had 3 entries left that were still valid out of, you know, the millions that came in. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, great. Just fun, and you can feel like we've turned a corner with the weather and,
that's what
all of that
yeah,
kind
exactly,
of
exactly, right.
So,
yeah.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up on the news. Producer Jasmine's fielding your phone calls. You can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And also on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin. And remember, if you have to tune away, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast by looking up iTunes and search for my name, Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got a great show today. And no, it may at times sound like a rerun of last week, but it's not. I've asked our pre-election roundtable to reassemble post-election. So joining me in studio will be my retired Tribune colleague, formerly part of the Tribune's political team, Bob Sector, Tom Bowen, a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, the former chairman of the state Republican Party. And we'll go through the ballot and talk about the campaigns, what happened, and what to look forward to in the fall. That'll all be coming up, and we'll be also taking our weekly spin through national politics. But right now, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And yes, it was a big election night for Hillary Clinton, sweeping Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Missouri, and yes, even her birth state of Illinois.
We know we will add to our delegate lead to roughly 300 with over 2 million more votes nationwide. We are moving closer to securing the Democratic Party nomination and winning this election in November.
And on the Republican side, it was another big night for Donald Trump, winning all but Ohio, which went to Governor John Kasich. Here's a little excerpt from Trump's early victory speech.
This was an amazing evening. This was a great evening. They just announced North Carolina.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've announced Illinois yet, but we're leading by a lot, so I think they're going to announce it. Florida was so amazing. And I want to thank our friends. Northern Marianas Islands have been so incredible, and we picked up 9 delegates this morning. I heard very early in the morning, 9 delegates, that's a lot.
That's Donald Trump. Maybe we can help resolve some of our nation's debt by taxing the use of the word amazing. That might be an idea. Well, Trump's wins have motivated a Stop Trump movement, but what if he gets to Cleveland lacking the delegates to win the nomination outright? Well, here's what he told CNN.
I think we'll win before getting to the convention, but I can tell you, if we didn't, and if we're 20 votes short, or if we're, you know, 100 short, and we're at 1,100 and somebody else is at 500 or 400, because we're way ahead of everybody, I don't think you can say that we don't get it automatically. I think you'd have riots. You know, I'm representing a tremendous, many, many millions of people.
Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan has insisted that if he has to, he'll find a way to work with Trump if Trump is the nominee. Here is Speaker Ryan speaking to CNBC.
We'll make it work if it happens. I'm going to speak my mind. I'm going to defend conservatism as I understand it. I'm going to defend our ideas as a Republican Party. But we're going to have to work with whoever our nominee is.
Now, that interview came before the crack about a riot at the Republican convention in Cleveland that Donald Trump made. And, of course, that prompted Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, to say this.
Do you agree with Donald Trump's statement that there would be riots?
I think that's...
If someone with a clear lead in delegates were denied the nomination?
Nobody should say such things, in my opinion, because to even address or hint to violence is unacceptable.
So there you go. Once again, the tensions between House Speaker Paul Ryan and the Republican presidential frontrunner, Donald Trump. Now, we had some interesting developments in the last couple of days. We had on the Monday before our primary, Mitt Romney was out in Ohio campaigning with Ohio Governor John Kasich. Then we move ahead. Kasich wins Ohio. We move ahead. You have Mitt Romney in Utah telling folks on Friday that the going with John Kasich is not enough, that will not prevent, as he calls it, Trumpism. So Mitt Romney says you got to go with Ted Cruz. There's a lot of internal debate going on in the Republican Party about that. Haley Barbour, the former Mississippi governor and former Republican national chairman, saying that he thinks Romney's call to arms for Cruz is a bit premature. But undeterred, John Kasich's super PAC went on the air to go after Trump and Cruz.
There was a time presidents were honorable, trustworthy. What's happened? We must stop Hillary Clinton. Voters in Ohio took the first step. Every poll in the country shows John Kasich can do what Trump and Cruz cannot, beat Hillary Clinton. Because character still matters. John Kasich is presidential.
New Day Independent Media Committee, Inc. is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, also big news last week, the day after the primary, President Obama formally nominated Merrick Garland, a native of the Chicago area, to fill the Supreme Court vacancy created by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, Garland, a member of the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and Obama unveiled him at a White House ceremony.
For a judge to be worthy of such trust, he or she must be faithful to the Constitution and to the statutes passed by the Congress. he or she must put aside his personal views or preferences and follow the law, not make it.
So that sets that up. But, of course, as previously indicated, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky says, you know, not so fast.
The decision the Senate announced weeks ago remains about a principle and not a person. About a principle and not a person. It seems clear that President Obama made this nomination not with the intent of seeing the nominee confirmed, but in order to politicize it for purposes of the election. Americans are certain to hear a lot of rhetoric from the other side in the coming days. But here are the facts they should keep in mind. The current Democratic leader said the Senate is not a rubber stamp, and he noted that the Constitution does not require the Senate to give presidential nominees a vote. That's the current Democratic leader.
That's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. And, of course, there is plenty of political agitation about this. It's an issue already in the early developing general election U.S. Senate race here in Illinois between Republican Senator Mark Kirk and Democrat Tammy Duckworth. Here's what Kirk told to my friend Steve Cochran last week.
I would just say to my fellow Republicans to man up and, you know, bring this guy and give him hearings. He can't bite you or anything like that. If you don't like what you hear, you can just vote no.
That's Republican Senator Mark Kirk. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll have our roundtable political panel to discuss the events of last Tuesday, starting out with some of the local races here at the Cook County and state level.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is The Sunday Spin, and I've reassembled last week's pre-primary political roundtable to now discuss post-primary. And joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Bob Sector, retired member of the Tribune's political team, Tom Bowen, who's founder of New Chicago Consulting and a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, former Illinois Republican chairman and co-founder of Next Generation Strategies. Gentlemen, thank you so much for getting up this morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the studio. I wanted to start out kind of on the local level because there'll be plenty to talk about the national level. But some very interesting returns in Cook County. Of course, we had the Anita Alvarez seeking re-election, and Kim Fox, former chief of staff to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. And I didn't know what to think how this would go because you still had Anita Alvarez name recognition, although not always good name recognition, not a positive name recognition with the Laquan McDonald incident. But so in the end, Fox wins by a 2-1 margin, 58% to 29%. Is it all Laquan McDonald related?
It's a majority of it. There are other factors. I mean, Anita Alvarez was elected in 2008, so she had a record that she had to run on, and there's a very famous 60 Minutes interview she did where she displayed that she had very little kind of political understanding of the consequences of that record, you know, not being done the right way. The state's attorney's office, the way she perceived it, was very minimal in its political outreach. There was a revolt in the Democratic Party, the Cook County Committee, in 2012, where an alderman was almost nominated over her for the party's endorsement, who hadn't been campaigning because her relationship with the African-American community was terrible. So the video was the catalyst, but there was plenty of dry powder waiting to explode.
Given that history, I mean, Bob, was this an automatic Kim Fox to you?
Pretty much so. I mean, as you said, when the Laquan McDonald video surfaced, it sort of cemented the her problems in the minds of many
but
people.
But what if that video, if you take that out of the equation, and I know you can't, but if you took that out of the equation, is Kim Fox still this new superstar?
Superstar, no. Okay. I would say victor, pretty likely. The party really had made the decision that she had to go, and but for a few constituencies, mostly Hispanic, that were, you know, going to remain loyal. The party had not endorsed, so she did not enjoy the support of the party at that time.
Right.
And, you know, when you start seeing the sort of folks that were supporting her, donors, you know, the Democratic Party has lots of little constituencies in it, but they were all, I mean, that's Donna Moore's credibility problem as a Democrat meant she could never, you know, wall off enough of that vote for, I think, Anita to be reelected. She needed those liberal white lakefront areas to go with Donna. It just struck us, political observers, you know, that are kind of more affiliated with the party there, that there was really only one choice for Democrats, and it was Fox.
Donna Moore getting 13% of the vote. Pat, I know you're Republican, but certainly you have experience in prosecutorial elections. And I mean, did you see this as an automatic Kim Fox victory?
No, I thought she was going to win. I said I was surprised by the margin. But more concerning to me is now that we have Tony Preckwinkle's former chief of staff in the largest prosecutor's office in the United States and the power of the Democratic Party behind her. It'll be interesting to see how she actually runs the office. And she made a lot of promises during the campaign, which are going to be tough to realize. So as a former prosecutor, my advice to her would be keep your head down, do your job, and make the reforms. Don't be out in front of this. Get down and do what you said you're going to do. Otherwise, this is really going to come back to bite her.
Well, and this is kind of like, as we were talked off the air, this is the two faces of that office is one, you know, to show concern and compassion for victims and those kinds of things. But then there's the hard edge, too, of this is an office to prosecute criminals.
Yeah, and I noticed that the County Board President introduced her criminal justice reforms, all, you know, not all of which, but most of which I think a lot of people agree with, and we all agree there needs to be reform in the criminal justice system, but we just want to make sure that that office is an objective arbiter of the administration of justice for everybody, and the job gets done better than Anita did in the last couple of years, and we don't get another Laquan McDonald assassination and hiding the tape and all the things that were messed up with that investigation and prosecution.
Yeah, and there's a management component to it that's really important. As Pat said, you know, the governor put forward a criminal justice reform commission. Many Democrats in the legislature and Republicans, there's an agreement on what policy changes need to happen, and that's great. That's a rare thing. But now it's about, you know, funding for the office and about managing 900 or so attorneys.
And that I talking to high-level people before the election, 2 years before the election, the complaint that a lot of the high-level people in Anita's administration had with the county board president was that she thought she ran the office, which she really doesn't. She doesn't run the sheriff's office. She doesn't run the state attorney's office. She runs the county board. And I think that caused a lot of the tension, which led to a lot of the political support for somebody else.
Well, also in the Cook County races, we had Dorothy Brown, the circuit court clerk, winning with plurality of 47.5% over Alderwoman Michelle Harris with 30.5% and Attorney Jacob Meister at 30%. You have to wonder if it wasn't for the intensity of the presidential race, the intensity of the state's attorney's race, if Dorothy Brown, her office under federal investigation, would have survived that election.
Yeah, high turnout is her friend here. And, you know, there are about 2 million, that's wrong, that's the statewide number. There's about 100,000 more votes cast in Cook County this time around than there was in the presidential race of 2008 when Hillary versus Obama was about the most exciting thing Democrats had seen in 25 years. And, you know, first rule in politics is be more well-known than the other person. And Dorothy has been on the ballot for, you know, several election cycles. As much as those of us who pay attention to politics are up to speed on the issues and what's going on, I'd bet you if half of the voters knew that her office was under investigation, I'd be surprised.
There's only so much you can process as a voter, and the Laquan McDonald issue was clearly much more salient than the somewhat nebulous investigation of Dorothy Brown. So it's true. I don't think a lot of people were focusing on that or paying a lot of attention to it.
Except the party folks were, and that they tried to orchestrate knocking her out, and it didn't work. And she still got elected, and she's going to get indicted. So in the good Chicago tradition, we'll have another.
Says a former federal prosecutor.
Yeah. But the point is there was some activity by the party on this, and it didn't work out so well for them.
Yeah.
So what does that say about the party and the value of being the slated candidate? It seemed to me there was not a huge effort expended on Michelle Harris's behalf.
Yeah, and I think the party serves as kind of a beacon for voters, right? There's a in a primary especially, helps you understand kind of who's on your side, who's against you. And in some of the other races, like the Duncan race, you know, the party's expressing in every interest it can to sort of say to folks, hey, you need to be over here. But I think this was more a we can't be supporting somebody who's, you know, likely going to be indicted. They did what they felt would, you know, hopefully push Dorothy out. It didn't work. And at that point, it's up to the candidates. You know, a lot of people talk about what the party's role is or what its leader's role are. But at the end of the day, the arbiter of who is successful or not is 9 times out of 10 the candidate.
Wait, well, interesting you say that, given that the headlines the next day after the election on Tuesday were the strength and intellect of the speaker and what a great manager is. So, I mean, I think it's a little inconsistent to say.
We're going to talk
about that.
We're going to come back and talk about the Duncan race and those legislative races. But first, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by our political roundtable, Bob Sector, formerly of the Chicago Tribune, now enjoying his retirement, Tom Bowen, founder of New Chicago Consulting, and he's a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman and co-founder of Next Generation Strategies. Before we turn away from these county races, I want to ask you something about going back to Kim Fox's win and the fact that Tony Preckwinkle was such a dominant factor in securing her slating. Basically, my understanding was telling people who wanted to be slated that unless you endorse Kim Fox for state's attorney, you're not going to get Tony Preckwinkle's support. And let's carry that further. Now, not that Tony Preckwinkle has had a great track record when it comes to endorsing candidates, but that having been said, how much of what happens now at the state's attorney's office reflects on Toni Preckwinkle and whatever her political future might be?
Reflects on her quite a bit because she's, you know, the supporter there. But to go to your example there, when Toni Preckwinkle tried to push Kim through with the slating process, it didn't work in the first go around because there was an incumbent state's attorney there. There were other candidates in the race that the party was sort of, you know, interviewing and thinking about, and for as much, you know, look, if you have an African-American block in the Cook County Democratic Party, you are very close to the slating.
Right.
But African-Americans didn't agree with Tony necessarily, and some of them knew Kim, but most didn't. So, you know, what reflects on Tony? Absolutely, because she is perceived as the sort of kingmaker in this. But, you know, what's going to happen in the practical realities of it? Is Tony Preckwinkle going to call in a favor or do something and Kim Fox, you know, listen to her? I mean, you know, those things are certainly possible, but that's not in Kim's best interest. And at the end of the day, she is now the state's attorney and it's her reputation going forward. So we'll see if she lives up to it.
Well, she's not the state's attorney yet.
Yes.
Give her a few months. But, yeah, I mean, you touched on something interesting. Tony Preckwinkle has, until this moment, has not had a very good record in political endorsements. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how she leverages this or doesn't leverage it. and we don't know yet what she's going to do.
I just think the state's attorney or the prosecutor's office is such a unique political office that it's tough to leverage it, but she can get blamed for it. If we get another Laquan McDonald and we get another slow walk of it like happened with Anita, I mean, Preckwinkle's going to wear the jacket for some of it. But another thing to consider is 99% or 95% of the decisions made in that office are made by line-level people. Kim Fox will not have day-to-day management. She can't. There's 900 lawyers of what's going on in that office here. You're always one bad police officer or prosecutor away from a really bad headline.
And that it tends to be an office where it's negativity, not...
Yeah, you never hear the good stuff. It's always the bad stuff.
And as powerful as they are, let's not forget, they have a day-to-day relationship with the Chicago Police Department, which is its own entity. They have to deal with not only the county, but the city and the laws and you know, enforcement of those laws that they're doing and has to do with Springfield. I mean, it's a, you know, and the sheriff. I mean, it's a massive...
It's the largest prosecutor's office in the United States.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift attention here to legislative Democratic primary races and some Republican as well. Obviously, at the top is the biggest proxy battle of the House Speaker Michael Madigan versus Governor Bruce Rauner election. That'd be Ken Duncan, the incumbent, losing to Juliana Stratton. Stratton getting 68% of the vote, Duncan 32%, spending of about $6.1 million in a lowly Democratic primary race that also included an endorsement from the President of the United States. Is there a larger picture, a larger takeaway from this, the fact of the Rauner allies providing about $4.1 million of that $6.1 million to try to keep Ken Duncan in place?
Well, I will say one thing about this just to answer Pat's point from before. Everyone likes to make things Rauner versus the speaker. The speaker obviously has a role in this, but let's not forget that Ken Duncan was the chairman of the Black Caucus, was essentially deposed from that position by his own members, and the speaker doesn't tell the Black Caucus what to do. The party itself, I mean, I had more friends volunteering on that race, which I wouldn't consider people that go regularly knock doors in the 13th Ward, because it was a understanding that Ken Duncan sold out to be with the governor and his allies. And if we didn't do something collectively here, we lose our ability to pick our own candidates. So what is the larger proxy battle here? Yes, there's an element of Rauner versus the speaker, but it's more Rauner because I think it's pretty clear that those folks were sort of singularly influencing Mr. You know, Duncan's allies there outside the one Chamber of Commerce thing. But no, you know, Democratic entities were with Ken Duncan. I didn't see traditional Republican entities. I didn't see the Illinois Rifle Association in that race. So Rauner versus the Democratic Party writ large in that race specifically.
Bob, is there a larger message here?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. There are other elements. And one element that always struck me as really odd was, I mean, Duncan was the guy who took the walk or walked away from two key votes last, what was it, August, I think? And one of them was on whether legislation that would have required the governor and the unions to go to binding arbitration. The other one, though, which is frankly more significant for his constituency, had to do with daycare for working moms. And remember, he went to New York to the U.S. Open. You know, you couldn't have picked a more poor symbol for somebody taking a walk on a vote. So, you know, whether he did it for Rauner, whether he did it for the self or whatever, the guy clearly has a tin ear. And, you know, so you can see the animosity in his own constituency building.
Pat Brady, we're going to get your thoughts on this when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and I've got my political roundtable panel here of Bob Sector, who's a retired member of the Tribune's political team, Tom Bowen, founder of New Chicago Consulting, and he's a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman and co-founder of Next Generation Strategies. Just a couple of personal notes here. On Wednesday, I'll be moderating a panel on the issue of immigration reform at Aurora University, part of their Town Square series. A number of panelists there, and obviously immigration, a very hot-button topic as we go into this political year. You can get more information at aurora.edu, or you can call 630-844-4924. And thanks to my good friends at Aurora University for inviting me back out there. Also, coming up on April 9th, my friends at the Literacy Volunteers from Illinois are having their On the Road to Literacy conference, and that's at the University of Illinois at Chicago. It's a great organization. I try to do everything I can to help support them, because if you work for a newspaper, like I say, I think you need to help these organizations. And there's all kinds of workshops and panels, including one on the importance of literacy and understanding what's going on in the political world. And I think now more than ever, some political literacy is needed. And you can get more information about the On the Road to Literacy conference Saturday, April 9th. You can go to lvillinois.org, lvillinois.org. That's the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois, and they do a great job. Well, gentlemen, I wanted to go back to talk a little bit about the legislative races. And, of course, obviously the Stratton-Duncan race got a lot of attention and a lot of money. But there were other races as well, including House Speaker Michael Madigan having his own contest, which I'm not sure was ever really going to be a contest. I think it was more, again, maybe Republicans trying to dabble in the Democratic sandbox.
And quite a few Democrats. I mean, I think the driver there was a gentleman named Blair Hull, former U.S. Senate candidate in 2004, and I do not know what he...
I was trying to figure out, too,
why he would think this is a good idea, but he was a huge backer of Mr. Gonzalez, and I mean, I knew some people that he had been calling Gonzalez to earn support, and, you know, anytime someone talked to me about that, I'm like, the speaker's going to win about the same number that he did last time, which was about 65-35.
The difference was this wasn't a candidate that the speaker put up himself this time.
Right. you know, it when things become proxy wars and it's easy for voters to understand, one is with the Democrats, the other is with the Republicans in a Democratic primary, it's an easy choice.
Bob?
You mentioned Blair Hull. I mean, we couldn't understand what he was doing in the U.S. Senate primary in 2004. I mean, he couldn't make a case for himself except for the fact that I've got a lot of money and I'm really smart. And, you know, he did not acquit himself very well. So why is he involved in this? Who knows?
I actually believe when I covered his announcement to run in that Democratic U.S. Senate primary, and I asked him the question, why are you running? And he couldn't answer the question.
And the guy that was number four in the polls at the time is now president of the United States.
There you go. Stranger things have happened in politics. Uh-huh. We also had, and this was a race that I think political watchers were watching, not necessarily people here in the Chicago area, but there was a Republican state Senate primary in the Springfield area. Sam McCann, the incumbent, who had voted the union's side in that arbitration bill that Bob referenced earlier, and was actually faced an opponent that was personally endorsed by Governor Rauner, and as well as, I think, got some campaign contributions that were not from Rauner directly, but aligned through him. And McCann ended up, despite, you know, having some serious questions about his background, he was able to win re-election. And I don't know there, because of the dynamics of that district, if that was a Democratic crossover vote?
Yeah, it was Democrat crossover that came in from Sangamon County. That's what it ended up winning it for him. And there's been some analysis afterwards. He's actually pretty popular in the district, got around a lot. Benton, a new guy, very impressive candidate. But I think the bigger picture in all these primary races, the governor and actually Jim Durkin, they ended up winning seven of the seats that they had actually supported candidates in two of those races downstate, the two races with the two young women down there. The unions, but backed by the Democrats, put Chills in to try to run against the Avery Bourne and Sarah Jimenez, and it didn't work out so well. So the two marquee races, the Duncan race and the Speaker's race and the McCann race, I guess three or two, I guess, because they weren't involved in the Speaker's race, worked out pretty well for the Republicans. The McCann thing, I think, will send a message. Maybe it's just considered a brushback pitch, that the governor, if you support him, he'll support you. If you don't, there's going to be consequences. And I think that was the message from that. Even though Benton didn't win, I think people get the message that the governor will support you if you're with him. And if you're not, he's going to work against you. And I think that's entirely fair.
It's worth mentioning that district is Sangamon County, which is where Springfield is. And there are a good number of state workers in that district, which Mr. McCann represents. So the number of folks that come into that primary the obviously state employees are sort of a feature of what the governor is talking about every day. So there were huge consequences in that race for those folks, and that can tend to change the composition of an electorate when the stakes are very high.
And we saw it in the governor primary with Kirk Dillard. I mean, that's where he made his gains and almost, got within 4 or 5 points of Governor Rauner in the primary. So you're exactly right. Down there, the voters, the majority of what carried the day for McCann was a crossover vote.
As a result of this primary, and we look ahead to November, do you think anything has changed in the dynamic of Springfield that is going to move anything off the gridlock? Bob?
No. I mean, that's the sad outcome here is that, Madigan and Cullerton still have clear majorities in their houses. The governor has his point of view, and he's not backing off. And, you're down to the saving face portion of this argument now. Each side is dug in, and to budge, to give an inch is, it looks like you're caving. And that's really a problem for the state of Illinois.
I think one of the consequences, though, of the Duncan race is that the speaker's going to have a supermajority again. And the argument against some of the downstate Democrats that are going to have contested races will be that if you vote for these candidates down here, you are voting for a tax increase, which is a very powerful argument south of I-64 in this state. So do I think their positions are hardened? Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Bob. But there have been some changes in the dynamics insofar as electoral politics way downstate.
We're going to come back to this subject, but first we have to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Bob Sector, Tom Bowen, and Pat Brady. 312-981-7200 is our phone number as we dissect the results of last Tuesday's primary. And before the break, Tom, we were talking about the issue of whether, the dynamics of the impasse in Springfield had really made any noticeable change.
They should. I mean, I think one of the governor's sort of sticks in this whole thing is I can put more money into this than any of you can. And clearly, money can make a difference in a lot of races, but in key contests, money becomes noise at just some point. I want to make one quick point on this that I think is relevant to the listeners. A solution really requires much less as far as votes than what we've been sort of talking about here. We've been talking about basically Democratic supermajority votes, two-thirds of the House and Senate, in order to sort of pass a budget over the governor's will. But there are more than enough votes for 50% of both houses to pass a solution, but the governor has declared that he'll veto those. So this can happen anytime, but it can happen with a bare majority which is what our Constitution allows, is for progress to be on any issue with a bare majority. It's, I think, really on the governor right now to explain to the public why, you know, the composition of the House and Senate with just its majority is not good enough to produce a solution.
Well, and there have been people that have raised the issue, you know, it takes 30 votes in the Senate, it takes 60 votes in the House to pass something. You know, why can't we work to find those majorities? And I tend to think more along the lines with Bob here that as long as each side, and we've been saying this for quite some time, and we're kind of looking maybe for some clarity in this primary results that didn't exist, that it didn't show itself, is that we now look to November for some kind of clarity.
Yeah. You know, let me go back to something that actually Hillary Clinton said during her, I think it was her last debate or the debate before that against Bernie Sanders. Sometimes you have to take a hard vote. And yes, there are clear majorities. Democrats have clear majorities in Springfield. But they're not going to pass a budget that is actually funded, and that means a tax increase to actually fund that extra spending, unless they can get some Republicans on that vote, because they're going to get hammered in November or afterwards. And that's the real crux of the matter here, is that Republicans in Springfield, in going back to when George Ryan was governor, had not had to take hard votes, do some things they don't really want to do, because it's probably in the best interest of the state. And, you know, until the governor comes to some accommodation with the Democrats and then says, I'm going to deliver a bunch of Republican votes on this tax increase, which we need to fund the extra spending that we also need, you know, you've got impasse.
Well, here, wait a minute. This is where I disagree. They have had a supermajority with early on, the first 6 or 7 months of the administration. They fought at everything. If they wanted to pass a tax increase, they could have passed a tax increase and overridden the governor's veto if they really wanted to do it. But that's where I agree. It's all about politics. They won't do it unless they can throw some Republican votes on it. Now, the governor has said, if you agree to some of my reforms, some of the things I want, very few of the ones he ran on, then I'll agree to a tax increase, which as a Republican, that is a really difficult political thing to do. But the Democrats won't do it. So, you know, they've had these supermajorities. They could have done this all along. They submitted a budget that was $4.5 billion out of whack. If they wanted that budget, they should have also introduced a big tax increase to cover it, and they could have passed it and overridden the governor. They just don't have the political will to do it. So I agree with the premise of your opening remarks. Yeah, sometimes you have to take a tough vote, but that shouldn't contemplate, well, we have to have some Republicans to come with us before we do it.
Well, but that is what political realities are.
But then it's all about politics. So we're conceding it's all about politics.
Well, and to be sure.
On both sides.
On both sides.
No, wait a minute. The Republicans are supporting the governor's reform agenda, which includes A, B, and C. The Democrats want this budget, this spending, but they're unwilling to pay for it. So it's on the Democrat side, it's about politics. On the Republican side, this is our agenda. They're very clear about it. We're not going to support a tax increase without reforms. The Democrats say we want to do the same stuff we've been doing for the last 12 years, and we're going to stick it to the taxpayers one more time with no change in the way things have operated.
To be fair, the governor also proposed a budget that was out of whack.
And those reforms don't save any money to actually deal with the budget situation. They're ideological reforms that strike at the core of the Democratic base. So,
like term limits?
No. Like redistricting reform? Like breaking
unions.
Like
allowing local units of government to decide how they're going to contract? Those are the core of the Democratic Party?
The right-to-work legislation, right-to-work initiatives that he's proposed break at the core of the Democratic Party as organized labor, and they're never going to pass it in a majority legislature, let alone a supermajority.
They'll take right to work off the table. Just let the local...
No, he hasn't taken right to work off the table.
Yes, he has taken right to work off the table. How about just redistricting reform, term limits, work comp reform, just some of the Democrats have not agreed to anything. Not one thing in his agenda have the Democrats agreed
to. They did not agree to the 8 constitutional amendments he proposed on his very first speech to the legislature, or the numerous other reforms that have nothing to do with the actual budget.
We took a vote.
Term limits have nothing to do with the budget.
Then you haven't followed Illinois politics for the last 30 years.
Let's bring things back here.
Yeah, we're friends.
Discussion. I understand that.
We haven't even gotten into Trump yet.
I like a healthy discussion, and that's what worried me, because we could carry on with all of this.
I know it's Sunday.
That's quite all right. But I want to be able to move on to the presidential politics and what happened here and the surprise of all that. But first, we're going to take a quick break. Before we get to Dave's newscast, you're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking about the outcome of the presidential political contests in Illinois, the close margin that Hillary Clinton defeated Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, and where Donald Trump's strength came from in the Republican side in Illinois. And that's with our panel, Bob Sector, retired member of the Tribune's political team, Tom Bowen, founder of New Chicago Consulting, and he's a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, former Illinois Republican chairman, John Kasich delegate going to Cleveland, and co-founder of Next Generation Strategies.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this bright and sunny Sunday, the first day of spring. We were talking about the very early on in the show, we were talking about the NCAA tournament, and Pat Brady said he saw this tweet regarding, we were talking about Michigan State being the busting everybody's brackets by losing. And what was the tweet that you said?
For Michigan State fans, this is the worst day since you got your denial letter from Michigan.
Oh,
phones
well.
Light up.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Bob Sector, Tom Bowen, Pat Brady, our political roundtable as we go through the results. And now we're going to move over to the presidential contest. Big turnout. I mean,
huge. More than 2008.
Yeah, which that was kind of the high watermark. And you're looking at almost 3.4 million votes cast in the state, almost 2 million from the Democratic side. 1.4 million on the Republican side.
That beats general election turnout, too.
Well, it was...
not combined.
Not combined, because... But still.
It's huge. It was bigger than the 2008 contest between the president and Hillary Clinton, which was shocking, at least in the Cook County side. I haven't examined every result across the state, but in a suburban district... Tammy Duckworth's district, there were 77,000 votes cast in that primary, and that is at least double, maybe even triple, the midterm. But even before that, there were in the presidential
right.
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge number of votes.
Well, what's to account for that? Was it the fact that you did have this very competitive race at the top of the ticket on both sides? Is that the driver?
Everything on both sides of the aisle. Local contests. There's a lot of consequential primaries at the state house level, the state's attorney's race. And a couple things drive turnout. The consequence of the election, which I think folks believe the stakes are very high. The sort of number of contests, a lot of contests on both sides of the aisle. And look, I mean, Trump has brought bigger ratings to any of the cable networks than anyone could have even imagined. Politics is in the air. When people are thinking about it, they go out and they, exercise their voice.
What do Republicans do now with Trump? We talk about the issue of the active effort to try to deny him the 1,237 delegate votes that are needed to win the nomination. I mentioned earlier about Mitt Romney. One day he's campaigning for John Kasich in Ohio. The next he's in Utah saying, vote for Cruz. Is this just talk, or is there really going to be an organized effort?
No, there is an organized effort. There actually was, but kind of kicked in before Illinois. But it's interesting to listen to Donald Trump whine about this. I mean, the rules are you need to get 1,237 delegates to win on the first ballot. If you don't get them, it goes to an open convention. He doesn't seem to like those rules and scream and yell that people are against him. Of course people are against him. It's politics. I'm one of those people against him. Mitt Romney's against him. 65% of the Republican Party is against him. So certainly there's going to be an organized effort now to stop him. And what's going to happen, I think, you're going to go to Utah where Cruz is going to win. You're going to go to Arizona. a winner-take-all state where Trump's likely going to win, and they're going to go up to these northeastern states, and we'll see if Kasich can make some headway. But the goal will be to dilute the delegates, and it's going to be hand-to-hand combat guerrilla warfare for these delegates, and we'll see what happens at the convention. In Pennsylvania and some of the other eastern states, some of these delegates are uncommitted.
All of Pennsylvania's delegates. They're all 54 of them are uncommitted delegates.
And a lot of these delegates have not even yet been selected because they're selected at the state convention. So you're going to get people that may not be committed Trumpites. So there's a lot of stuff going to happen here in the next 8 weeks.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin. Ron, are you still with us? There we got you. Go ahead.
Okay, good morning to you and your guests. My question, just assuming that Hillary Clinton and Trump win the nominations for their party, typically the candidate that moves more to the center wins the presidency. Which one of those candidates would have the biggest challenge as far as moving to the center, but also maintaining their base? So that's my question.
All right, Ron, thank you very much. Thanks. Great question as always. So, who can move closer to the center for the general, Trump or Clinton? Who is easier to move towards the center?
I'm going to give a two-part answer. Trump will move more to the center because he has absolutely no gumption about what he says, being, you know, tethered to reality or his past statements. Clinton should successfully move there and still maintain credibility. But, I mean, unless anybody else disagrees, I think Donald Trump would say, you know, anything.
But he's going to spend the majority of his campaign explaining comments about women, about Hispanics, about veterans, about blacks. We're never going to get to issues with Trump. It's all going to be about the statements he's made, some really pretty nasty statements. That's what the Trump campaign is going to be about.
Well, you know, you go back to that very first debate where he complained about Megyn Kelly asking him what is a very obvious and fair question. He's going to do that. But the problem is, this is the same problem we had with Governor Blagojevich was, he would say stuff, amazing stuff that contradicted the last thing he said, and he couldn't understand that we had these things called tape recorders and video recorders and things that actually document
and
what
federal
you say.
Wire overhears.
Well, later. Yeah. And there's so much of what Trump has said that it's going to be very hard for him to credibly go to the center, even though his most devoted fans, I don't think, care what he says. I mean, they're going to follow him down.
Well, he's kind of already there. I mean, a lot of the things he said policy-wise, including his tax plan, including his so-called entitlement reforms, are more to the center. But he crosses every line.
Yeah, I mean, because the argument being among some of Cruz supporters is, you know, that Cruz is the true conservative, and people on all sides have been trying to pick apart him as not being somebody that embodies Republican ideology. But again, it doesn't seem like it matters.
And he's so as a Democrat, I'd prefer to run against Cruz because that playbook's very easy. That is,
there is a playbook.
Yeah, there is no playbook against Trump, and my belief is that most of the electorate has probably written him off, where that he is a weak general election candidate. But I tell you, if CNN's going to give him an hour of free airtime every time he does a rally, and he gets in there and just starts saying things, and it's the first time you've actually started paying attention to what he says, and he goes, oh, that kind of makes sense.
Did you see the analysis that he's received $2 billion in free media?
Free media is always much, much larger than any paid media.
And did you also see the analysis when they followed him for 4.5 hours, and he tells a lie every 6 minutes?
Well, you know, which is concerning. I mean, how do you run
for
against
the democracy, not just as a Republican?
Weird infomercial he did a couple of weeks ago where he, in Gary Hart fashion, challenged people to check it out, and everything he said was untrue.
Yes, the Trump steaks, the Trump winery that he owns debt-free, that he doesn't own the winery.
He literally will say anything.
There are certain realities, though, in politics that you have to win certain percentage of certain groups to win as a Republican. 40% now of Hispanics, certain percentage of women. You can't win with just angry white guys.
Right, but the concern is the folks in the middle, right, the late deciders, they tend to be low-information voters. And if it is close for any reason, and he's just willing to say whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That's a playbook that we're not used to.
They've been breaking away from him, though, in the primaries, though. The light voters.
He said, I love the poorly educated. So
there you go, the late deciders. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Bob Sector, Tom Bowen, and Pat Brady. And Pat, as I mentioned, is a John Kasich delegate, and he's actually a successful John Kasich delegate, and he was elected in from his congressional district to go to the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in July. An interesting factor on how you actually won that delegate spot.
Yeah, you did the analysis too, and I think the Washington Post and a couple other, that it, apparently the Trump voters would not vote for Trump delegates with foreign-sounding names. So when I was in the 6th congressional districts, and the two names ahead of me were very foreign-sounding names, and apparently I got in because they wouldn't vote for the two ahead of me. So probably Trump's worst nightmare, I'm going to be a delegate on the floor at the convention whipping for John Kasich.
With a front-row seat.
Front-row seat, yeah.
Front-row seat to boot. I went through the exit polls, and I think they get some short shrift sometime because, you know, you've got the election and it happens and then it's move on to the next state. And, you kind of can see a little bit of how the electorate went in the state through these exit polls. And one of the things I thought was very interesting, but overall was the fact about, in large numbers of Republicans and Democrats both saying that the economy was their number one concern, 93% of Republicans saying they're worried about the economy. And when you look at the actual numbers, it comes down to roughly how the primary results turned out among the various voting blocks. But one thing, you had Trump has made these strong statements about immigration, and yet 56% of Republican voters in the primary say that undocumented immigrants should be offered a path for legal status in the United States.
Yeah, just like Ronald Reagan did in 1986.
Well,
he offered amnesty. So this position, hardline position Trump's taken, is not the conservative position. It's way further right than the party's ever been.
And the other thing, too, is that you have 40%, 4 in 10 Republicans saying that they would actively consider looking at a third-party candidate if Trump and Clinton won the nomination, with an outright 33% of Republicans, one-third of Republicans, saying they absolutely would not vote for Trump. But here again, who would that third-party candidate be? We're hearing, the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry.
Yeah, that New York Times coverage today, I think that's missing a huge reality. The ballot access laws in all 50 states are different.
Right.
To actually have a third-party viable choice to get that person known to the right sets of voters, it is really too late.
Couldn't
I think,
they go join up, though, with a party that's already on?
The Libertarians.
The Libertarians?
Yeah,
the Greens? Are they on?
I don't know if the Greens are on nationally, but the Libertarians and their convention or their process, I believe, is end of May. It's similar in Bob and I were talking before the break here about what Democrats did in 1986, where the LaRouche's took over our party and we formed our own party. That is extremely difficult to do in any state, let alone in the 30, 35 states you're going to need to win the presidency. Because remember, if you do not get a majority in the Electoral College, this goes to the House of Representatives, which frankly might be a better strategy than actually trying to win the presidency.
Yes, I've heard that mentioned.
Yes, and I mean, that's just another reflection of what an unusual political year this year is and what unusual political dynamic.
Reporter's dream, right, Rick?
Well, we want to take a little bit of a breath here, but
here's the nightmare scenario of that vote in the House. Imagine a Trump presidency for the Republicans, a third-party person, and Democrats were to take the House because he hurts the down ballot so far. So the old House, gaveled in, would be the one picking the president, not the new one. So that could be, a democratically led House and Senate picking a Republican for president.
It's like House of Cards.
Wait, actually, writes it's funny. Stuff. I don't want to give it away, but I actually have watched the new season of House of Cards, and if you kind of grind your way through it, it's a little ridiculous. The very last episode kind of has a Trumpian flavor to it. So
stop right there, okay, because I haven't gotten to it. Let's just talk about on the Democrat side and the exit polling results. And obviously, you know, when we did our Tribune poll, and that was early in March, and, you know, here's Hillary Clinton way out in front, and then here comes Election Day, and just Hillary Clinton by the narrowest of margins here. And is that entirely the youth vote? Is it, I mean, what?
So when you look ward by ward in Chicago, and that's kind of my interest, so that's where I went first, you know, Bernie basically wins a combination of Hispanic and then kind of newer, you know, gentrifying area, maybe you call it hipster or something like that. So the 35th Ward is a perfect example of where Bernie does really well. But if you get to the lakefront, especially more older lakefront, 46, 43, 42, or 44, I meant, those folks voted for Hillary. And then African-American wards on the west side and the south side voted for Hillary.
Yeah, and there, much was made about Bernie Sanders' strategy of trying to tie Clinton to Rahm Emanuel and how unpopular Emanuel is in
right.
the African-American community.
And that
but
didn't work.
But you look at the I looked at the African-American majority wards, too, and she won 64%, I think.
Yeah.
It was 64%. Might have been down a little bit, but
the
I don't
thing
know.
That's really important about that, and you know, I look at more results than exit polls because exit polls. Just,
well, this was actual results
yeah.
I'm talking about.
But what was interesting to me was Bernie Sanders probably spent about $3 million in Illinois on TV, and that is a lot of money in a very short time. And he had a you know several message tracks running, and the ones I saw were very Wall Street based, very populist, very things are not fair, vote for fairness, and that's hugely appealing to all constituencies in the Democratic Party.
But he also did run the Hillary Rahm ad. He also ran the Chewy Garcia ad.
Yeah, and I think that helped him in the Hispanic community. That you can see very clearly he did better in Illinois than he did in other states with Hispanic constituencies.
They did bring in the 82nd Airborne, though. I mean, the President of the United States here campaigned on the South Side, so they did pull out all the stops in the Clinton campaign.
Yep.
Well, and in fact, I was somewhat surprised because the original schedule was basically after Sunday, that was nobody was going to be here, and then to come back, and also I was surprised that it wasn't Hillary Clinton going to the African American churches on Sunday, but it was Bill Clinton. Who
hey, can
was
I ask
going.
Tom a question because it's your show?
Very quick.
So, what was the Rahm factor? Nothing.
I don't think the Rahm factor played in there as much as people are making it out because, look, voters make decisions at the top of the ticket, and it's who reflects their values. And, you know, if you see some principal who you have no idea who this person is talking about school closings, the message about school closings has been going on for, you know, two straight years, and it didn't work in Rahm's own mayoral election. So I doubt that it works in the presidential.
All right, gentlemen, we have to bring our roundtable to a close. I want to thank you, Bob Sector from the Tribune's political team. Tom Bowen, founder of New Chicago Consulting, a Democratic consultant, and Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman and co-founder of Next Generation Strategies. We're going to take a break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin. Well, I want to thank our roundtable, Bob Sector, Tom Bowen, and Pat Brady, and most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been a wild ride through this primary election, and now we look ahead to the wild and crazy roller coaster that's going to be the November general election. And Dean, I got to tell you, I got to go out and see more movies.
It's like your sorbet to cleanse your palate,
yes,
your political palate a little bit.
I mean, the mind wanders.
I can only imagine. I mean, that's how a lot of us are into it, but probably a tenth of what you are and your panel.
Well, and I like good political thrillers and everything, but that's what this is turning out to be, is just this most unique, unusual election year that I've ever seen in my life.
I would have thought it was more of a romantic comedy.
Really?
Maybe a farce. A farce might be more.
Megyn Kelly and Donald Trump. Maybe this is all a ruse.
Maybe. Stranger things have happened in this election cycle.
Have a great show.
You too. Chicago. Well, I guess the show's over. So for next week, you too.